Welcome to the Infrastructure Podcast. My name is Anthony Oliver, and today we're going to talk about the challenge of designing sustainable and resilient transport solutions as part of a decarbonised infrastructure future. The infrastructure profession has a massive role to play in helping the UK to tackle climate change and ensure that the nation stays on track to meet its net zero emissions targets by 2050. It is my pleasure, therefore, to welcome Rachel Skinner to the Infrastructure Podcast today. Rachel is Executive Director for ESG and Government Relations at Consultant WSP and a very well-known advocate for embracing low-carbon futures, something that she championed during her year as President of the Institution of Civil Engineers in 2020. And she's leading the new Interchange event as Chair of the Advisory Panel, where she's helping the supply chain to accelerate towards sustainable and resilient transport solutions. Rachel, welcome to the Infrastructure Podcast.
Thank you very much. Brilliant to be here.
Well, let's get straight into the challenge, Rachel. As I mentioned, your year in office at the ICE focused on the need to decarbonise society. So I suppose the question is, I mean, are we getting there? You know, in this drive towards net zero, sustainable future, I mean, how important is decarbonising those transport systems in meeting those goals?
That's a big question to start with, but let me start really simple. There is no path to a genuine net zero position for the UK or indeed any other developed country in the world without decarbonising transport. So in the UK right now, transport is the number one emitter in a domestic sense of our carbon emissions that are out there, you know, every day, every week, every month, every year, etc. And while we have had a lot of change already, so some of it to do with energy supply change, some of it to do with increased electrification of some of the transport systems, some of it about, you know, really new thinking in terms of placemaking and active travel, micromobility, that kind of thing. Remembering also it's not just about people, it's about freight. And there's another challenge there, because of course that's a very, very significant contributor to that carbon emissions data, and yet actually it's one of the hardest pieces to decarbonize. Lots of that stuff is already moving and shifting, kind of good, but it's still hanging out there at the top of the list in terms of, you know, on the naughty step, if you like. And it's essentially the case right now that yes, we're doing some of the right things and we're going in the right direction, but we're just not going fast enough. This is all about relative change. This is all about fast-paced change and going in the right direction. And at any time, if we're standing still, then effectively we're actually going backwards.
So it sounds slightly worrying. I mean, my question, are we getting the answer? Sounds like no. But yeah, the point that you're making, of course, is that transport is a very complex and interconnected sector. And I suppose one of the things that I see with this decarbonisation challenge is that the solutions are very different if you're looking at urban transport or rural transport or long-distance intercity travel, freight, international travel. I mean, where should we be focusing first from that short list?
If only there was an easy answer where we could just pick out the top three things and off we go. Honestly, we need to have, in terms of a first focus, a kind of a broad look across everything in this transport sector, everything that is already out there in terms of operational systems, everything to do with our use of those systems, everything to do with the investments we're planning to make and so on. And then we need to pick out the easy stuff, because actually there is still a whole pile of easy stuff to get at here. We know, as I've just said, what direction we have to go. We're beginning to understand where the carbon really is. And we're beginning to be brave and actually kind of looking it in the eye and starting to do things about it, which is great. But actually, there's an awful lot of stuff that could be done at relatively low cost, sometimes even actually a cost reduction. And there are things that are in our direct control across all those different things you just mentioned, and all of them will help. So I think it's less about picking out like one or two single big ticket items and actually looking for that thin layer beginning of change everywhere, because that pace and accelerating the pace of change is the key to actually making, you know, the necessary difference that we need. And it's funny actually, because just the other day we've heard from the National Infrastructure Commission, John Armitt and his team there, where they've made a very, very similar point around accelerating the pace of change. And obviously that's not transport specific, but it's across all the sectors. But at the same time as saying let's do the easy stuff, I don't mean then let's ignore the really difficult stuff. Actually, we also have to start to dig into those, you know, the difficult pieces and get some of those some of those balls rolling, ideally downhill. There's some great thinking, for example, in the review that was recently done by Chris Skidmore for the UK government.
Right, yeah.
There's some really good work being done in terms of educating ourselves, in terms of the language, the complexity, the whole life systems thinking we're going to need across the whole of this space. And so we do have a pretty decent idea of where those big changes are actually going to happen. So, yes.
But the challenge is that, you know, so often, you know, the solutions, you know, is thought of as if we stop flying, for instance, then everything will be fine. Or if we don't use diesel cars anymore, then everything will be fine. We just, you know, but what you're saying is that it's there's more to it than that. It's a very complicated area.
It's massively complicated. On the one hand, you could say, yes, of course, we need to do all those different things. But some of it is about, I guess, the physical changes that we need to make to our transport systems, to our places, all types. We need to make it possible and safe and easy and fast and affordable to make sustainable or more sustainable, lower carbon choices in terms of how we move around. Nobody's saying we don't want to move people or goods, but we've just got to think much more intelligently about the true impact of that movement. So there's a physical piece in terms of infrastructure, but let me have one more thought on the other side of it. It's as much about the behaviour change as well. We as society, put down all of our engineering and infrastructure and professional and technical hats for a minute. We've just got to become much more conscious about the impacts of what we do every day and also the every so often type activities. Because in my view, and I hope you don't mind me sort of speaking fairly plainly here, I think we're total fools if we listen to people who say, oh, we won't have to change our lifestyles. You know, we've got hard planetary boundaries here and we are currently a million miles off.
I mean, how radical do we need to be? I mean, do you see the challenge being, you know, about, you know, just decarbonising existing modes, you know, a world of, you know, electric cars, electric trains, or replacing them with new modes? You know, I'm thinking about micro mobility, you know, e-scooters, you know, e-bikes, you know, and other things which, you know, perhaps we don't even know about at the moment.
So I think there is no getting around the fact that we do need wholesale change to our mobility and our digital connectivity systems for people and goods. But it's not about sort of, you know, banning whole swathes of movement, that kind of thing, in my view. It's about making sure we actually have more suitable ways of moving around and connecting for the right kinds of trips, if they are actual trips that need to be made, or you know, to connect in other ways if that's also an option. I mean, clearly we're not suggesting anybody's going to take their e-scooter on a trip across the country, but then nor should we be driving a petrol or a diesel car to the supermarket that's less than 10 minutes walk away, you know, if you're just going to go and pick up a few things.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So I don't think it's about abandoning the systems we've got and starting again. We've got to work with what we've got. We've got to invest in a really, really smart, intelligent way to make sure that we are valuing the right outcomes. So there's obviously big pieces from everything I've said already in terms of the carbon elements here, but it's also about social equity and the pieces around levelling up. Transport as a sector has a massive potential to deliver on that. And to some extent, we've been aware of this for a long time, but have we ever really valued those outcomes in a way that genuinely changes the decisions we actually make? I would suggest that we could do a lot more. It's also not about building nothing, before people jump on me for suggesting that. We have to build the right things, but our definition of right needs a proper kind of kicking and thinking and all the rest of it. So, yeah.
Okay. So the big one, you know, from the perspective of designing sustainable, resilient transport solutions, are we right to spend billions on projects like Crossrail and be committing even more to projects like HS2?
There's another big question. You like these ones. So from my point of view, and this can only be a sort of a personal view on these things, can't it? We are absolutely right to continue to invest in projects that build connectivity, because obviously, you know, the more connections we have, the more alternatives there are, particularly where they provide more sustainable options in terms of movement. That's a good thing in terms of the social and the economic benefits. It's also good for resilience in terms of having other options. And I don't think we should spend too much time, if you like, beating ourselves up and putting on our 2020 perfect vision hindsight glasses. I think actually it's more about now looking with fresh eyes at the potential to invest going forward in projects that continue to fully mitigate their impact as we now see them. And that's the key thing that's changing, isn't it? We're seeing different impacts. You can't see carbon dioxide because it is invisible. And it rather, you know, unhelpfully doesn't respect political and geographical boundaries and all the rest of it. But now we do see in a right. scientific sense, the impact. So now we've seen it. We have now got to do more to put it right. And you okay. could argue the same for the social side of things as well.
Well, let's dig in a bit to this rethink of transport to actually deliver that change. And we mentioned you're helping to drive the new interchange event, which is described as the hub for mobility infrastructure. And it's about integrated and intelligent transport infrastructure to deliver this, as you say, social, economic, environmental benefit. I mean, how would you say that that rethink of transport actually delivers those greater benefits?
So from my point of view, I think exactly as I was just saying, this interchange conference, but not just as a one-off, as a sort of a moment where we start to really shift the way we think about transport as a system, as an enabler, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's less about changing the areas we kind of investigate. We know we've got to think across the social and the environmental and the economic. We've had that. That is part of the key proper definition of what sustainability actually means and has done since the 19 whatevers, you know, in terms of it's decades right, old yeah, in yeah. terms of definitions and so on. It's about, in my view, elevating the importance of the pieces that we now recognise we need to value more. And that is really, really hard because what we're trying to do is compare values that don't naturally fall into the same units. How do you really square up, you know, I don't know, journey time savings to keep it with a, you know, pure transport focus with the true benefits of creating multiple new routes to new educational job opportunities or the value of the tons of carbon saved over the next 100 years because of changes you might be able to make today? Yes, there are sort of methods to do all of that, but ultimately we need to make sure that those methods are something that are actually adequately reflecting and translating through those things that help us to make better decisions, because that's how we're going to be able to define whether things are working better in terms of the benefits of the transport system. And I think just coming back to the change point overall, I think we also just need to take a moment and recognise just how much the transport sector really has changed. You know, we're not delivering in the same ways as we used to. We're not designing, we're not building in the same ways, we're not running the systems in the same ways. The digital overlay, whether we're talking about the digital models help to come up with options, whether we're talking about digital twins that improve operations, whether we're talking about user-based apps, huge change in terms of just how we understand the systems and how we can see the problems and how we might dig into, you know, improvements, I guess. And I suppose, I mean, gosh, it's terrifying to think this is my 25th year of working in the industry and being an accidental transport person, even an accidental engineer, actually. We'll get onto that a bit later, perhaps. But there has been such massive change in terms of that data that's available. And just, I suppose, really, coming back to the Interchange Conference and to me, the reason why I agreed to chair that advisory board and to help to really, you know, bring together a really exciting group of people to think about this a bit differently is because it's a fantastic opportunity to get across that change and really do something with it.
Well, let's talk about you for a moment, because, you know, yeah, you have established, I suppose, this role of something of a convener, but you're a transport planner by background. You've carved out a hugely successful career as an engineering consultant that was initially Parsons Brinckerhoff, then became WSP. You were named as the Telegraph's newspaper's inaugural Top 50 Women in Engineering in 2017. You know, you've been recognised as the most distinguished winner, the best woman in civil engineering. And as I mentioned, you became the second woman and the youngest person ever to be president of the ICE in 2020. So you're smiling there. I mean, what has been key to your success? Because, you know, you have, you know, become this, I'd say, a convener of people that, you know, gets change happening.
I wish I could answer that question, is the honest answer. I didn't set out, you know, almost 25 years ago now to gather up any of that. Being brutally honest, that's not in itself what makes me tick. Yeah, I'm really proud to have been the youngest ever president of the ICE. That is massive in the grand scheme of things. I'm obviously, you know, really proud to have picked up that recognition along the way. But honestly, I guess I'm just sort of calling it as I see it. I mean, I like people. I like problem solving. I like that being able to bring that kind of curiosity and sort of thinking to some of the most difficult problems. And I suppose, I mean, from my point of view, I did fall into all this stuff by accident. Funnily enough, actually, I was first employed by Kennedy and Donkin before it was even bought by Parsons Brinkhoff, by the way. There we go. Right. Anyway, it goes back even further than that. No, it doesn't matter. But actually, I came into the world, it's a geography background I came in from. I didn't know about civil engineering at all. It hadn't genuinely crossed my path until I first came into employment. And maybe that's part of it, is that I haven't gone through, you know, some of the more traditional training routes. I knew about sustainability. I knew about the first Earth Summit back in Rio in 1992 because I studied it when I was doing my degree course later on in the 90s, right, yeah, for example. I think all of that's kind of a strength, really. You know, you see it from a different perspective.
Last month was International Women's Day. I mean, is it getting easier to be a successful woman in infrastructure?
Is it getting easier to be a woman in infrastructure? I would say it isn't currently that easy, if I'm really brutally honest, to be a woman in infrastructure, but it gets a lot easier if you're the kind of person who doesn't mind being different. And it does worry me slightly that the women who are currently in our broad infrastructure space, and I'm talking here about all the different sectors where we have, in most cases, you know, a real imbalance between men and women, and also obviously other diversity characteristics as well. You know, we are very, very imbalanced. It does worry me that as we move towards being a set of sectors where we genuinely have a more diverse balance, the sort of women in particular who we're going to want to attract are not necessarily the kind of women who are like the ones who are already here. And I mean that in the nicest possible way. We need to think really carefully about what sort of people we're trying to attract and what will keep them here as well, because we cannot assume that the past is a guide to the future on this stuff. So yes, it's tricky. I guess one thing I'm desperate to mention as well, just a quick plug as well, from an ICE point of view, there's a fabulous initiative going on at the moment in terms of connecting together some of the senior women across the civil engineering community. So it's called ICE Connects, and the gender angle is just one piece of this. But I think Michelle Dix also mentioned this in her podcast with you recently as well, where you can tell we're on a bit of a campaign.
She did, yes.
It's really, really fundamental effort to bring together the women who are in these different sectors. We don't get to spend very much time together, a lot of us. And so it's fantastic to have the opportunities to come together and talk about it.
Which goes, I mean, clearly you are a role model, but it goes to the point, I suppose, that, you know, that you're a patron of women in transport, a founding patron of women in transport as well. So, you know, that organisation and the ICE, the ICE's drive, I mean, the reason that organisations like that are still so important is because of that, that collegiate angle, that bringing people together, is it?
Yeah. We always joke, there are so many of these women in various organisations around the place, and the reason they all exist is because they're all much needed. We always joke about, wouldn't it be lovely if we didn't need to exist anymore? I'm afraid we are still a very, very long way away from that. I don't, though, want to imply that things aren't getting somewhat better. There is far more recognition of the issue. There is some good work going on to try to address this, but we, I'm afraid, cannot afford to sort of, you know, turn our eyes to other things and start to ignore this, because it's pretty hard work to get as far as we have done, and it's only through that effort that it's going to carry on improving.
Yeah. Well, you're super busy at work. We've talked about, you know, some of the work you're doing, and but what do you do when you're not at work? How do you let off steam?
I'm just as busy outside work as I am inside work, but
I'm sure you are.
what does it say about a busy person? Anyway, what do I do outside work? Well, a lot of people will know already. I have three kids. Two of them are now firmly into the teenage territory. So my part-time roles outside work, in a very boring sense, include chauffeur of Antisocial Hours, I guess director of time management, chief of revision planning. I'm very good, by the way, at GCSE maths, chemistry, biology. Should anybody need that at the moment? But no, being more serious, what else do I do? For me, I enjoy things like running. As you know, you've seen me out there on the towpath by the Thames.
I love
DIY. I'm always fiddling and tinkering and building cupboards. Or at the moment, I'm busy designing our home battery system, which I'm hoping to put in over the next few months. And I love gardening, actually. I've love gardening recently. A slow time project, because it takes years, right?
Goodness me, it's
I know.
It's exhausting. Your life is exhausting. Well, it's just a very quick fire questions then, just to check out your sustainable credentials. You mentioned your battery installed, but let's get a few more quick fire questions. I mean, do you still have an electric car?
Certainly do. So we've been a one car household since before we had kids, and obviously now got three of them. So we've stuck with that all the way through, kind of on principle. But we've been fully electric. So let me think, since 2017. Yes, EV since, full EV since 2017.
Okay, these are quick fire.
Yeah, go on. All right, I get it.
How often do you fly?
Only when I absolutely have to. I took literally one flight to do with my ICE year. Admittedly, there was a COVID issue for most of that. I think I took one work-related flight last year because there was literally no other option. I've taken no flights yet this year at all.
Would you ever fly domestic?
Not by choice.
Okay. You mentioned a little bit earlier, but what steps have you taken at home to reduce your carbon emissions?
Here's another little essay. Right, the short list. Heat pump from 6 years ago. We've got solar panels, obviously the EV just mentioned. 100% renewable electricity supply into the house for the bits we do need to buy. No gas. Busy, as I said, designing a battery storage system now, with a bit of help actually from a WSP colleague, which is quite handy.
Very good.
Yep. Is that a long enough list? Doing my best. So very good. Doing my best.
And much insulation, hopefully, as well, that goes behind.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
Have you ever used an e-bike or an e-scooter?
An e-bike, yes, once. Don't own one. E-scooter, not yet. Normal bike, all the time. Part of my commute, as long as it's not too hideous outside.
I have to say, e-scooters terrify me. What would you say is your biggest contribution to your personal carbon footprint right now?
Good question. I haven't looked it all up recently. I get quite frustrated with some of those online calculators because they don't let you put in all those things I've just listed out there. They don't know what to do with it. I would imagine now it's probably coming down to things like food, clothes. I'm not a huge clothes person, but even so, rail travel, I'd imagine, things like that. Yeah.
Good. Let's talk about creating a sustainable and resilient transport solutions, which, of course, this podcast is all about. I mean, you work for a global business, and you're a non-exec director of the World Green Building Council. I mean, how far behind, I suppose, or ahead are we in the UK compared to the rest of the world in our tackling of carbon?
This is a really interesting question, isn't it? Because I think over time now, we're beginning to see that there is more of a kind of regional race, a country by country race going on, which I think is actually quite a good thing. A bit of competition doesn't hurt on this stuff. UK side, I would say, when it comes to net zero, and obviously the UK was the first major developed economy to set itself a legally binding net zero goal for 2050. Many others have since followed. So in terms of the policy setting, in terms of some of the thinking on that decarbonisation journey, I think the UK is still in, a really decent position. On resilience, though, totally different topic in terms of the defensive side of all of this, when we're talking just about the climate pieces, but obviously resilience also stretches into all sorts of other topics as well. I would actually say the UK is not anywhere near that leading pack as things stand. I think there are other places in the world that have had a much more sharp wake-up call, and that has been driving a different kind of policy setting and so on recently.
But we are doing some things. I mean, you're a fellow of the ICE, of the Royal Academy of Engineers, the engineering profession is helping to accelerate the transformation. And I think you've just launched the PAS 2080 standard to help in this area. I mean, what's that all about? Just give us a quick synopsis of what that's all about.
So PAS 2080 overall, it doesn't sound the most exciting title, but when you understand that the rest of the title is essentially to do with carbon management in infrastructure, you will start to understand how important that is. So PAS 2080 is not brand new. It was first published some years ago. This is an update to PAS 2080 that has just been released over recent weeks. Essentially, what that does now is it brings together the whole of the built environment. So all of infrastructure and buildings. So the previous version didn't include the building side of things. And it's essentially the international standard that will now guide change in terms of understanding carbon impacts. It's not the methods of how you quantify it, but it's the process, the thinking you need to go through in terms of getting across what those impacts actually are, in order to make sure that from an infrastructure point of view and a built environment wider point of view, we make the right decisions, or at least better decisions.
Well, let's finish on that note. Going back to the Interchange event next week, and the strapline describes the gathering as an accelerator for essential change. The time is now, it says. I mean, to be fair, the time has been now for quite some time. What, in your view, has to happen to make sure that the necessary change does actually happen?
Right. The time is now. I guess I'm going to sort of garble on purpose slightly, you know, a well-worn saying here, you know, the best time to make difficult changes is obviously yesterday, but failing that, the next best time is today, which I think is where that line has come from. I mean, a lot of what I've said during this conversation has spoken, I think, around the urgency of change and the need to up the pace of change to accelerate in a very literal sense. And not because it's interesting, not because it'll keep people like me occupied for years to come and so on, but because, as I said before, we literally have no choice. And I think that's the key message that has to underlie all of this stuff. And if we don't believe and start to act as if there genuinely is a climate, a biodiversity, etc. crisis, then frankly, you know, I suppose that's our choice in terms of our own professional behaviours. I think we can all agree there is. I don't tend to come across many people who say there isn't these days. So we have to lead and start acting like it. And I don't think we can point at other people and say we're waiting for them to do something. So we have to start to make that change wherever we can.
And if you were, you know, if you were talking to a young infrastructure professional who really wants to grab this and run with it, how do they do that? What's the thing that they need to do to really get involved and help make that change now?
Honestly, I genuinely mean this when I say it. There has never been a more exciting time to get involved in all of these different things I've been talking about here. The fact that genuinely we are heading into this territory where we have to make these changes means that stuff will have to happen. It is literally that simple. And we can sort of dodge it in our brains and think, I'll do it tomorrow. But we're only kidding ourselves if we do that. So I would say, in terms of young people coming in now, honestly, if you're interested in careers that will genuinely make an actual difference on the ground in terms of climate, in terms of social equity, in terms of all these big pillars that we all know we care about very, very deeply, absolutely now is the time. And you're in charge of your own career choices. So take charge and get on with helping us lead that. You know, the knowledge that people are bringing in at the more junior end is hugely valuable right now. And we've got to educate the whole profession that's already here as well. It's quite a task.
Rachel, thanks so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure to talk to you as always.
Absolutely brilliant. Thanks so much. Speak again soon.
Thanks very much, Rachel. As I say, that's all we've got time for today, but we're going to have a lot more from the Infrastructure Podcast. We've got lots in the pipeline and more guests to talk to as we continue to probe the big issues faced across the sector. If you haven't done so already, do check out the new Infrastructure Podcast website. That's www.infrastructure-podcast.com, where you will find background information and all the latest podcasts to listen to and to share. So thanks for joining us. Thanks again to Rachel, and I look forward to seeing you again very soon.